Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. The Jewish power structure uses Judaism in many ways, not least as a means of exciting a kind of religious awe that neutralizes the defensive instincts of the host populations among whom the Jews live. But Jewish activities are clearly not organized and directed through their faith. For many of the leading figures in the Jewish establishment reject Judaism as a formal religion, yet still act in concert with other Jews, displaying a racial solidarity and discipline that seems amazing to us. Since it is the Jewish power structure that is the main force behind the effort to commit genocide against our race, it is necessary for the new white elite we are building to fully understand this, the greatest question of our time, the Jewish question. No man is better qualified to increase our understanding of this subject than the late great Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver, classicist, linguist, scholar, and one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. This week, we continue our excerpts from his insightful work on the subject under the title, The Jewish Plague, Part 7. I give you the words of Revelo P. Oliver. The Jews' religion, which, as presented to the Goyim, seems to validate their boasts of a peculiar righteousness, makes possible the greater part of their secular, that is, economic and social, subversion and eventual destruction of the nations they invade. It must be remembered that the Jews operate by discovering and exploiting causes of dissent within nations, inciting classes and comparable groups within the nation to reciprocal antagonism, and exacerbating the rivalries to the point of civil war, until the nation is paralyzed and reduced to masses of individuals who no longer feel they have anything in common except the geographical territory they inhabit. The Jewish technique, as was too candidly explained by the notorious agitator Herbert Aptheker, consists in finding large groups of goyim who can be isolated from the rest of the society on the basis of some economic, occupational, regional, cultural, sexual, or racial interests they have in common, persuading them that they are oppressed by the wicked society, inciting them to hatred of their oppressors, and making them greedy for the profits they think they can gain by demanding their rights and thus setting each group against all others until the nation is paralyzed by pseudo-legal contention that may hopefully be expected to eventuate in civil wars, massive massacres, and a reversion to total barbarism. The Jews, who are always careful to wail that they are a persecuted minority, with a passion for godly justice, are thus ideally prepared to incite the underprivileged to outbreaks for social justice. And it is, of course, well known that all of the multiple forms of subversion are directed by Jews, often quite openly, although they usually try to associate with them some hired or light-headed members of each group they are inciting to what will be, in the end, self-destruction. The same parade of religiosity facilitates the other principal offensive against the occupied nation, if it belongs to our race, which is morbidly susceptible to rhetorical appeals to sentimentality and ideals, that is, fancied changes of the real world to make it more pleasant, usually by some magical transformation of human nature. Aryans, especially females, are easily intoxicated by rhapsodic talk about all mankind, the brotherhood of man, world peace, equality of races, all men are born equal, and similar nonsense. That adult Aryans believe in such things without help from lysergic acid or even alcohol is simply proof of Kipling's observation that, quote, words are the most powerful drugs used by mankind, close quote. The Jews cannot be held responsible for the mental weakness they exploit, nor even for their success in exploiting it. In the United States, for example, they have, for decades, been openly inciting the Congoids to plunder, beat, rape, and murder their white oppressors. And the white Americans are not only so craven and masochistic that they submit themselves and their children to the savages' outrages, but so fatuous that they believe the Jews' pretense that they are acting out of concern for the underprivileged savages rather than out of hatred for the Aryans, as well as to profit from the misfortunes of the modern Canaanites, whose country they have effectively occupied. The Jews' contempt for their befuddled and spineless victims is probably justified, but I think it obvious that their success was made possible in the United States, as, according to Philo, it was in Canaan, by the awe excited by their religious professions in the minds of the unwitting enemies whose country they invaded. Conspiracy or instinct? This summary of the Jews' most useful devices leaves us, of course, with the question how it is possible for the dispersed and widely scattered members of the race to act with what amounts to unanimity and perfect coordination. It is scarcely credible that so large a number of individuals, many of them showing a low order of intelligence, could carry out such operations according to a consciously formed plan on which they have all previously agreed. The great mass of Jews seem to be, almost without exception, under the tight control and discipline of their fairly numerous leaders, who could, in turn, be equally subject to the orders of a supreme and secret directorate, which plans and directs a conscious strategy, as set forth in the famous protocols. This is possible, although Aryans are apt to think most unlikely an operation of which they would be utterly incapable, of which they are, we must believe, genetically incapable, since their earliest records in the Homeric traditions, the Norse legends, and even the Vedas, attest the great difficulty of maintaining an effective consensus within even compact and comparatively small bands for specific, immediate, and limited ends. It is a pernicious and perhaps fatal error, characteristic of our race, to assume that other races have approximately the same nature as ours. So that argument against a conscious and concerted conspiracy must be discarded. The alternative to that theory, so far as I can see, can only be an hypothesis that the Jews are directed by instinct, at least to a large extent. They may represent a complex and highly advanced form of the biological phenomenon of which a simple manifestation is seen in mammals that hunt in packs or bands, as is well known, wolves and African wild dogs, for example, hunt in organized packs and stalk and bring down their game by a kind of strategy that is carried out by the pack as a unit, but with each individual in it having a definite function and adapting himself to the needs of a specific situation. This activity we attribute to instincts operating entirely below the level of real consciousness. African baboons form bands that are really small tribes, having an oligarchic government, and their survival under very adverse conditions is proof that they adapt their presumably instinctive methods to new conditions, and that they learn by experience and observation. It is assumed, however, partly from the structure of the baboon's brain and the absence of a real language, that the species is not capable of conscious thought. On the other hand, we are aware that although we may, on strictly objective grounds, identify our race as having a peculiar capacity for objective thought, many of our actions are determined by instinctual and subconscious reactions. For example, our perception of beauty, fear of death, reaction to odors and sounds, etc. However much we may consciously try to rationalize them or alter them by efforts of the will that are likely to produce schizophrenia. It is entirely possible, therefore, that a species could have been formed by biological selection that automatically preys on our species, as instinctively as wolves prey on caribou, although, of course, with much greater cunning and versatility. Extermination. This hypothesis is open to the objection that, so far as we can tell, a distinct change has taken place in the Jews' activity in this century, and at approximately the time of the Protocols. Before this, the aliens seem to have been content to exploit the Aryans, and in biological terms, feed on them. The present objective is obviously extermination of our species through mongrelization and massacres, so that it would seem that the organization and domination of the Jewish colonies by the Zionists produced a change in purpose that must, to a large extent at least, have been consciously determined and planned. This implies some measure of rule by some kind of directorate that has the ability and power to set objectives for the race. The alternative is to explain the change as a natural result of the progressive weakening of our race by less direct attacks during the past 1,000 years or more, comparable to the change in activity of a wolf pack when it senses that the harried caribou are nearing exhaustion. Whatever the explanation, the Jews' determination to exterminate the Aryans is not unreasonable. One may see a good analogy in the cattle that are raised in the southwestern part of the United States. For a long time, the favorite breed was the Texas Longhorn, which was hardy, able to fight off coyotes and other predators, and to survive in the wilds until it was rounded up by the cowboys for a long drive to the market. But it was also a dangerous animal that would attack its owners when provoked. It is now virtually extinct, having been replaced on the ranches by more docile breeds, such as the Black Angus. Since the predators have been exterminated, and the cattle now graze within fences or are simply fattened on corn provided for them, and the vigor of the potentially dangerous longhorn is no longer needed, while the more docile and sluggish animals yield more tender meat. Early in the 20th century, Aryans had, for all practical purposes, subjugated the entire world, and made it everywhere, both safe and convenient for the Jews. Whereas events in Germany in the 1930s proved that Aryans could be dangerous to the master race if they got out of control. Elimination of the species seems, therefore, a logical step for the self-styled God people. Genetic integration. I shall add a disquieting consideration, that so far as I know, no other Aryan has taken into account. It is based on the work of Dr. Alfred Nossig, whose manual of advice to his race on the best means of expeditiously taking possession of the entire planet, published simultaneously in Austria, Germany, and the United States, Integralis Judentum, Vienna, Berlin, New York, 1922, must once have been widely distributed, but has now become extremely rare, so that I had to search for years before finding even a battered copy of it. Most of what he says is, of course, mere commonplace to anyone who has observed the Jews' techniques. But there is one claim which, if true, explains much and leaves us with little or no hope, no matter what may happen in the future. He boasts of a genetic infiltration of our race that probably renders us helpless. According to Dr. Nossig, any taint of Jewish blood will so alter the brain cells of many subsequent generations of an apparently pure Aryan family that the descendants will be susceptible to Jewish propaganda and can readily be mobilized against their own race. What is more, Dr. Nossig seems to reject the usual Jewish view that the genes of Jewishness, like hemophilia, are transmitted only through females, so that only the offspring of Jewesses, regardless of the race of their father, are real Jews. This, of course, explains such varied phenomena as the degeneration of the British aristocracy, which some observers trace partly to the common practice of covetous or necessitous Britons of marrying their sons to Jewesses, who were provided with fat dowries and often dunked in holy water to make them more acceptable, and the kidnapping of male German infants in 1944 and 45, who were taken to Israel as breeding stock to improve the physique of the race. Dr. Nossig, astonishingly, seems to believe that the heredity is transmitted by Jews of either sex. This means that, for example, if a Jew in 1800 seduced and impregnated an Aryan matron, her descendants, even today, after many generations of marriages to pure Aryan stock, would all have the Jewish tumor in their brains and be subject to control through it. And when one tries to guess in how many nests the invading cuckoos may have laid their eggs through the centuries, one shudders. Dr. Nossig is obviously convinced that the genes of Jewishness are not only dominant, but have a power of dominance greater than is attested for the genes of any physical trait. That does not conform to the theories held by most modern geneticists, but I can find no scientific corroboration or refutation of the claim. And I need not point out the methodological obstacles in the way of determination of the inheritances of specific mental traits in individuals, even if research on that subject were freely permitted. You've been listening to The Jewish Plague, Part 7, written by Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver and presented by your host, yours truly, Kevin Alfred Strom. To read more of Dr. Oliver's works, visit nationalvanguard.org/Oliver. That's nationalvanguard, all one word, .org/Oliver. We'll continue this important discussion of the Jewish question by classicist, scholar, and teacher, Dr. Revelo P. Oliver, next week on American Dissident Voices.